now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. I hope that you're having a pleasant day so far. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, the show that highlights reclaiming that which you have always been. And I'm very excited to be with you here today, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. And for those of you new to the program, or if you're, you know, returning to the program, and I always like to share at the beginning of these broadcasts, one of my dearest beliefs is that I truly, truly believe that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life in terms of our giftedness, our uniqueness, our personality, our skills, our talents, our strengths, and so forth. Yet, as we go along in life and due to perhaps some unpleasant experiences, we may tend to hide the very best parts of ourselves in order to survive, let's say, a traumatic event, or perhaps there had been some bullying going on in our life, and we have just been afraid to show our very best, and we tend to shirk back. Okay. However, whatever it is, we push down our giftedness, our uniqueness. We push it way down so that others cannot see, not just people who may have hurt us in our lives, but also the people who love us dearly, let's say. Or perhaps there was a time when we were told we would never amount to anything. Okay, and we really bought into that kind of a message, and it just really emotionally scarred us from thinking that there would be anything more to us than what other people see. And that's just simply not true, because when we do realize our giftedness and we go through life functioning from not a place of wholeness, but we come from that place of woundedness. When we don't realize that giftedness, but when we do realize our giftedness, we do come from that place of healing, a place of wholeness, a place of hachetas, uniqueness, thisness. And yet, certainly, there is so much more to us than what we've become so far, and this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, finding that courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Well, it is certainly my great pleasure to be with you here today, and I hope that wherever you are, that you are indeed safe and you are at peace, and I hope your heart is at peace today. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, please do. But visit my website at www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word. So it's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you'd like to be part of the show today, I invite you to call in. You know, please call 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And in case you missed this show and you want to catch this or another show in the archives, these shows are podcasted. So you can go back and listen again and again, as much as you would like. And I'll be taking your calls after the break today, because I really want to hear from you on today's subject. It's entitled, If I Only Had a Self, What Intergenerational Trauma Steals From Us. Okay, a little bit different topic today, just looking at intergenerational trauma and really what it robs us or keeps us from reclaiming those very best parts of ourself. Just wanted to start today's broadcast with a very poignant quote that I came across earlier this week. It's from the developmental psychiatrist, Eric Erickson. And he's the one who's given us developmental psychology and looks at the total lifespan throughout our lives and just highlights the hurdles, so to speak, that we have to get through or get over, the little tasks that we have to accomplish simply because we're getting older. Things like when we're, you know, 2 or 3 years old, it's a matter of learning to tie our shoes and learning to dress ourselves. And by the time we are young adults or older adults, we've mastered that many times over. But because we're in that developmental stage of, let's say, the middle adulthood or later adulthood, we have some new tasks and challenges that we would need to get through. But anyway, this all comes from Eric Erickson. And the quote I just want to share with you is right in line with what we're going to be talking about today. And he says, "Healthy children will not fear life if their elders have integrity enough not to fear death." I'll say that again. Healthy children will not fear life if their elders have integrity enough not to fear death. In and of itself, that's a powerful statement because it says something about how life's lessons are kind of passed down from one generation to another, to another, and to another. And this really strikes at the heart of intergenerational trauma. It's the trauma that's being passed down through the generations and landing on specific people, and they have no idea what's really going on. They have no idea where all this is coming from. Perhaps, let's say, something happened back in the 70s or 60s or 70s or even 80s, and something very, very traumatic that was never dealt with by an individual or by a family, and that trauma, you know, is passed down to their children, either genetically or just through what's the lessons that have been taught and the lens, so to speak, of how people see the world, what's being passed on through that. Either way, the generations that are now much younger and those yet to be born, they are faced with coming to terms with this trauma, but they never faced themselves the traumatic event. And that's the uniqueness of this intergenerational trauma. They're acting out as if they have experienced a traumatic event. However, because it's in the genes or because the behavior or perceptions have been passed down, it seems to kind of, you know, stick to future generations. And again, they have no idea where this is coming from and, you know, just really at a loss. But one's understanding that it comes as something handed down from, you know, the generations or one family after another, tackling intergenerational trauma takes on a whole new perspective. Right? So over the years, there's the treatment for PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder, has indeed taken on many forms. Perhaps you've seen or even heard of exposure therapy or talk therapy, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, good old MDR, EMDR out there, and even the classic hypnosis. As I said, there are just many treatments for PTSD. And regardless of the treatment that's used, the desired outcome for everyone is always the same. They want to reconnect to that which they had lost. And of course, you know, personal safety is still the primary concern for a person who has been traumatized, and as triggers always have the potential to create unsafe conditions or unsafe feelings in the person. In fact, a traumatized person may even seek professional help in alleviating, you know, these above symptoms. However, in conjunction with the person's safety is the overall goal of helping the person reconnect with their relationships. Yet there is a caution here. Reconnecting interpersonal relationships by examining your personal assumptions about a sense of control and power in their lives, as well as healing, the interpersonal relationships in which issues of trust, safety, and self-esteem, etc., all those things may have been shattered by the traumatic event. And the person is left with, say, the psychological, emotional, maybe even spiritual, and maybe even physical pieces. As they're looking at the pile of the shards and so forth of what their life has unfolded for them in the moment, they may wonder, you know, how can I be put back together? You know, where do I begin? Where do you start with all that? And you add to this phenomenon that, you know, this task could be certainly difficult of helping the person be put back together, so to speak, or help them to heal from the intergenerational the trauma. A lot of people I've run into have taken on the persona of the trauma that they have experienced. And this is what I mean. It's like they allow themselves to be defined, to be defined by the trauma itself. And as you said, that as a result to this phenomena of intergenerational trauma, what's been handed down has not only been the traumatic symptoms that were once felt in the person, but also this distorted view of themselves. You know, because they've identified with their, the so-called lot in life or their traumatic experiences, and just simply are convinced, like, well, this is typical of me. This is typical of my family. This is typical of how it's always been for us, and you know, that kind of, shall we say, indirect teaching gets handed down to where the future generations just automatically assume that nothing good can come from them because they've heard for so long that, well, nothing has yet to come, you know, the good out of the family. And that's just a lot of weight for future generations to kind of dig out from. But it is possible. It is possible. So there's this ongoing debate as to, how does intergenerational trauma, how is it passed down? And as I said, it's either from a nature or nurture standpoint. And from a nature viewpoint, the beliefs center on the traumas being contained and handed down through the genes. And there have been fabulous studies that have been done on epigenetics and so forth. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But the all found within the changes in the DNA from, let's say, the great-grandparents to the grandparents to the parents to the children, et cetera, and however far back you want to go. But on the nurture side of this debate, there's this belief that trauma is passed down through the way we were raised or our attachments with our caregivers, as well as how we develop throughout our lives. And to be honest, you know, both sides present this convincing example of the transmission of trauma. But in the end, it's a both and kind of understanding. It's, yes, there's the nurture side, and yes, there's the nature side. I think that's a very healthy way to understand intergenerational trauma. So one of the things that I've run into with people, you know, just talking about this nature-nurture aspect of intergenerational trauma is just trying to explain that although we may be predisposed to a trauma by what's happened through, you know, the family line or happened a long time ago, but it's also how we are nurtured, you know, that also affects to the degree to which intergenerational trauma can be triggered in us through this unresolved trauma. And now our, you know, great grandparents or grandparents and parents and so forth. And Professor Hurley, she had, again, just written extensively on intergenerational trauma. And I came across a quote that is just, again, phenomenal as she explains this intergenerational trauma from a nature-nurture kind of standpoint. She writes, "Like silt deposited on the clogs of a finely tuned machine after the seawater of a tsunami recedes, and our experiences and those for our forebears, those experiences are never gone, even if they have been forgotten. They become a part of us, a molecular residue, holding fast to our genetic scaffolding. The DNA remains the same, but the psychological and the behavioral tendencies are inherited. And you just may have inherited not just your grandmother's knobby knees, but also her predisposition towards depression caused by the neglect that she had suffered as a newborn. And again, that's just a very healthy way to, I think, understand the just a complex issue at times of intergenerational trauma. It's this understanding of, you know, it's a both and, nature and nurture. Well, on the nature side, as I said, the studies of epigenetics has just been gaining tremendous traction over the decades, and really is just providing us just tremendous insight into understanding just how people are affected and on what levels they're affected, to what degrees that they are truly suffering. And when this is understood, especially my clients that I sit and I counsel with, when they understand this, the whole need to blame themselves goes away. This whole understanding of, oh, wait a minute, this is not my fault. I'm not lazy. I'm not stupid. I'm not miserable and everything else that you know, people have been putting labels on for me. And that's true. I reassure them that is definitely true. But you know, certainly intergenerational trauma needs to be healed, even though that understanding. And as I'll share later on after the break, that it's not an issue of blame or finding out who's responsible for this, for the rest of the family suffering. But to approach intergenerational trauma with the understanding of, you know, finding a way to bring healing to the entire family and to the individuals that are really struggling with it in the present day, as well as keeping it from going forward. So regarding epigenetics, I once read an article. It was entitled, Can Trauma Be Passed Down Through Our DNA? And the author stated that many people that, you know, they believe their physical traits and family illnesses just simply cannot be changed. And, you know, the author really challenged this notion and states that although people do indeed pass on the exact same chromosomes from grandparent to parent to child, it's the quality of these chromosomes when they are received that has the potential to enhance or diminish according to what has happened to us and the choices we make during our lifetime. Okay, and this is kind of a nod to Pavlov's theory of classical conditioning. I don't know if you remember that from your either high school days or college days, but classical conditioning is a theory but from Ivan Pavlov, where he was able to condition a dog's mouth watering when, you know, as it were in response to the smell of meat powder after every time he would ring a bell. And after he would ring the bell, that's when Pavlov would produce the meat powder, and of course the dog's mouth started to water. And eventually the dog got used to this, and he learned to associate hearing the bell with food. And this initial experiment, after he just kept doing it over and over again, this initial experiment led Pavlov to further understand how just we as human beings are also conditioned by various experiences. A good example of this would be a person who's had a near drowning experience might become conditioned to fear the sound of any kind of rushing water, such as the crashing of ocean waves or, you know, just a very fast, rapid torrent of a river. And the sound of that water can certainly just kick up, conjure up heightened anxiety or hypervigilance, a pounding heart rate, obviously, sensations of suffocation, tightness in one's chest, et cetera, et cetera. And while there is an element of safety in our fear itself, especially if a person cannot swim in rushing water, but fear becomes altogether another matter when the same physiological reactions are experienced when you're just simply filling a bathtub with water. You see, the element of danger is reduced, yet the mind and the body could still be reacting and shifting into survival mode as if there's danger. Yet, are these self-preservation conditioned responses something that we keep to ourselves, or have they been passed on, you know, genetically to us from our ancestors? Well, another researcher, Diaz, with the Department of Psychiatry at Emory University, suggested that such experiences are somehow transferred from the brain into the DNA, kind of like a fingerprint, which not only changes the structure of the chromosome, but also conditions the genes to be passed down later. And he writes, from a translational perspective, our results allow us to appreciate how the experiences of a parent, before even conceiving offspring, they have this marked influence both structurally and functionally in the nervous system by subsequent generations. And they may not even be aware of this. And so as this is being passed down to children, you can clearly see just the effect of epigenetics, just how the genes have been changed. Now, moving away from the brain here for a second, I don't know if you've ever heard of the HeartMath Institute, but they're also doing cutting-edge studies now and looking at the relationship between the head and the heart, or the brain and the heart. In fact, they, what I read last time from the HeartMath Institute, that the heart itself functions as if a second brain, as if we have a second brain. And it, you know, the studies that they have shown, you know, that they write about showing how the heart generates a powerful electromagnetic field, which can be measured about several feet away from a person's body. And, you know, it's just interesting, because I don't know about you, but how many times that you've walked by somebody and you've felt this certain negative vibe, or sitting by people who are expressively happy and feel a certain lift in our emotions? I'm certain everybody has at one time or another. Just being around people might just bring us down, or it might just lift us up. The same is true with us. I mean, without us ever realizing it, our cardio-electromagnetic field gives off information whenever we are angry or fearful, depressed, or experiencing some other negative emotion. And it also gives off empathy, compassion, gratitude, and love when we experience something positive. And so it's just, again, quite fascinating, the studies that are coming out of the HeartMath Institute as it's being related to intergenerational trauma. Now, there's also been studies that have been done mainly throughout World War II and just in times of war to see how that kind of trauma is passed down. And there was one particular study I found that was related to World War II, and it took place in the Netherlands. And this actually, this historical event occurred when Hitler's troops invaded the Netherlands, and they took control of the country somewhere around 1940. And the Netherlands, the Dutch, they took a neutral stance in the war. But to avoid capture, the Dutch government and the royal family fled to England, you know, just for the sake of saving their lives. And in support, I'm sorry, of the Allied war effort, the Dutch government in exile in London called for a national railway strike to hinder the German military initiatives. However, in retaliation in 1944, the German authorities blocked all food supplies to the occupied west of the country. And this was described as a time of the hunger winter, or the Hagen winter, which was a time when food supplies became increasingly scarce. And for about 8 months, there was this widespread starvation and infectious diseases of the digestive system that had just been coming up, obviously, because of the lack of food. And it was especially seen in the western parts of the Netherlands, where this blockade was. And interestingly, such trauma also affected the outcomes, the reproductive outcomes of women who gave birth during this time. And these newborns who were exposed to this famine during gestation were reported to have lower birth weights, malformations, and increased mortality. But in addition, these long-term developmental effects of the famine could be seen in this increased physical and psychological effect of infants born during the famine. They had a lot of stomach issues. They had just a lot of digestive issues as a result. And the conclusion is picking up the trauma of the mother in utero and so forth. So this is also just, again, more fascinating studies as to exactly just what are we talking about here when it comes to intergenerational trauma. Well, one of the ways that I look at intergenerational trauma is through the eyes of Heinz Kohut. He was a self-psychologist, and actually he wrote a book in 1971 called The Analysis of the Self. And I really, really enjoy his take on how he sees humans and humanity in general, and just how do we grow and develop. Not just cognitively or emotionally or physically or spiritually, but overall, looking at the greater perspective. And he sees a person's self as their psychological being, of course, but also we consist of these sensations and feelings and thoughts and attitudes towards ourselves and others and the world. And to his credit, according to this model of self-psychology, it was Kohut who understood our ability to overcome many issues in our lives as stemming from an underdeveloped sense of who we are. Again, not only are we simply not aware of who we are, but also we're not aware of, again, our gifts, our inner beauty, our strengths, and everything that we also possess. And, this is something that I certainly connect with Kohut on, that, coming to this world with everything that we have, it's just that we haven't realized it yet. We haven't discovered it. We're still in this state of, an undeveloped sense of ourselves. Well, along with the self-psychology, there's this object relation theory that's out there that says that we have external objects in our lives, and these things we use to substitute for what we really want in relationships, such as love or acceptance, peace, intimacy, nurturing, and courage, and so forth. But to develop a healthy self, we're required to internalize these qualities, the intimacy, the nurturing, the courage, from the external objects in our lives. For example, let's say we grew up with a favorite stuffed animal or toy, and we learned the value of comfort, fun, and companionship. We had a playmate who was always with us. That, it's just what this toy provided for us at, an appropriate age. And the reason why, these external objects, like say a teddy bear, connects with us is because it meets on some level this inner emotional and psychological need. However, although this is normal behavior in childhood, as we mature, and again, as we're internalizing these qualities, and we can now substitute the stuffed animal or toy for more meaningful emotional, physical, and sexual intimacy in the relationships with others. And if we are unable to do this, we're going to struggle to reciprocate these human qualities in meaningful, life-giving ways. Let me ask you a question at this point. How many of you had seen the movie Ted? All right. Remember? Mark Wahlberg, and Ted is the overstuffed teddy bear. And this is certainly a soon-to-be classic example of Kohut's understanding of this underdeveloped sense of self and just object relations of you know, we're supposed to grow out of these, you know, teddy bears and toys and so forth. You know, but if you've ever seen the movie, you realize that, you know, John Bennett, who was then a 35-year-old man-child, he received his childhood wish that he made when he was just a little guy, wishing that his teddy bear, Ted, could come to life. And growing up, we see all throughout, you know, John's life that Ted had served as a great companion. He was a confidant. He had unconditional love for John. But unfortunately, John never internalized these qualities that he received from Ted, this object, and thus struggled to find meaning in relationships, namely with his girlfriend, Lori, who, you know, Ted was always around for that as well. So, well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So if you would like to call in and discuss intergenerational trauma, let's say from a nurture or nature standpoint, I invite you to do so. The number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after this break. And again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in about 1 minute. Well, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to mention to you briefly about next week's show. We're going to continue this theme of looking at intergenerational trauma by discussing how the land often holds the traumatic injury and the energy following a traumatic event, such as, let's say, a natural disaster or the battles that were fought on the land, genocide and so forth, or other means of specific atrocities that humanity has inflicted on one another. Again, this is just a phenomena that's gaining traction, gaining notice in the public eye regarding the issues that it just seems like the land is very much a connection to that. And I'll be sharing with you some of my experiences of just not only sensing how the land holds this, you know, emotional, psychological, physical, spiritual trauma, but also the times when I was involved in helping clear the land from this negative energy as well. Well, earlier, I was talking about self-psychology just before the break, and it was Heinz Kohut, good German psychiatrist. He understood our inability to overcome many issues in our lives as stemming from this underdeveloped sense of who we are. And, you know, we're just not only aware, you know, or simply not aware of who we are, but we're also, again, then unaware of just what gifts lie within us, you know, the beauty and strength that we possess. However, our external objects in our lives have been substituted for what we really desire in relationships, and it's this love and acceptance, peace, intimacy, nurturing, and courage. And many people, let's bring it into the adult world, shall we say, many people also look at external objects in order to satisfy, you know, these inner stirrings of the soul. And this is something that, again, comes up in counseling therapy quite a bit with people as we go a little bit deeper, and look underneath the, let's say, the initial emotional outbursts or the, as they say, the habits that they have kind of like latched onto. And we take a look at, just what has been substituted in their lives that they use to find comfort or to find that peace or to find that reassurance. And this could be whether they're objects that provide pleasure or happiness or comfort, security, or peace. Again, there's this realization that those objects can never touch the cry of the soul consciousness that connects us with God or the divine or the universe. And these objects, whatever they are just poor substitutes that on one level serve to meet our emotional and or physical needs. But the reason why we cling to these external objects is because on one level, they work. They truly, truly work. For example, alcohol. Alcohol is a depressant. It calms people down. It calms down the emotional anxiety and stress. Cocaine, on the other hand, is a stimulant, and it boosts mental and physical energy. And then we have the sexual orgasm that releases dopamine in the brain and provides this physiological sense of elation. And even if we spend quite a long time in our, let's say, a physical workout, that also releases endorphins, and it provides us with this analgesic feeling. Yet, on the other hand, if we truly want to understand ourselves as soul and really get to the heart of intergenerational trauma, you have to learn that these external objects always point us to connect with a higher consciousness that really helps us transcend our emotional, psychological, and physical realms. In fact, as we listen to the cry of our soul, if we truly, truly, with the greatest intention, listen, we realize our deepest desire is to connect and reconnect to the pure sense of who we are. In fact, this cry of the soul is so powerful, so deafening at times, that once we fully embrace ourselves, we're never going to be satisfied with anything else. Well, as I said, in order to internalize the qualities of external objects, we have to first have this awareness or this realization of, like, this is what we're doing. And like, say, for like the alcohol or the cocaine or whatever the object is, realizing that it can never fully provide everything that we need. So returning to Kohut's theory here of self-psychology, as I stated earlier, trauma of any nature, just any experience that we've gone through that is just very traumatic for us, has this potential to disconnect us from who we are as a soul. The reason for this is because the trauma, I think, places this distorted template over our perceptions. This is what I mean by that. Trauma says to us, this is all there is. This is all there is to you. This is as good as it gets. And all lies and distortions that come from other wounded people, we realize that they have yet to embrace themselves as healthy individuals, as souls. But once we embrace ourselves as a soul, we're going to be astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform that this wounded energy, but it's also going to empower us to help others to do the same. But still, as history teaches us, many have feared the resiliency and the power of the soul and have therefore tried to silence its cry. And again, this is something we're going to be taking a closer look at next week. But our history is just filled just throughout the world, and especially in America, regarding killings and murders and genocides, starvations, forced assimilations, humiliations, degradations, looking at people as savages or primitive or backward, unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable. as other people would see fit. And the mindset is, well, if we kill the person or we kill the people, then we're going to silence them. And that is just simply not true, because in earlier broadcasts, I've shared with you my thoughts on that, regarding that you just simply cannot silence, you know, the cry of the soul. It is just impossible, because it's energy. It is energy, and you can never destroy energy. But what's heartbreaking to me is that our atrocities that we kind of are reminded of down throughout history have often been committed in the name of God. And this is actually committed by people who should see themselves as soul. They should know better. But again, we cannot take this for granted. In fact, every time, even when there's a killing done in the name of God, the only thing that's truly advanced is this distorted view from those who will do anything to perhaps, let's say, hang on to their power. But still, as I said, you cannot silence the soul. There's a wonderful story I heard years and years ago. It's the soulful wisdom of indigenous grandmothers. And there's always a part of me that I need to see this ceremony one day. I just need to see it, because I've heard nothing but great, great things about it. And at one point, it almost died out among indigenous people, but the grandmothers kept it going because it is that powerful. It's actually this ancient tradition which involves a powerful blessing from the grandmothers whenever a baby is born. And before the newborn is returned to the mother, the grandmothers of the village would take turns holding the child. And they would look deep into that child's eyes, and with a very loving tone, the grandmothers would, one by one, speak words of affirmation to the child and tell the child how much they are loved by the community, loved by God, and gifted with many good and precious gifts as a beautiful soul. And this grandmother's tradition begins this internalization process for the child regarding the love and security and trust, and truly reinforces the idea that it indeed takes a village to raise a child. There is a beauty that I see quite a bit in counseling therapy that's not just about alleviating mental health symptoms in clients who are troubled. It also involves helping people discover who they are and the gifts and character strengths they have. In other words, helping people remove their emotional or behavioral or spiritual obstructions so that they may embrace their authentic selves. And from my book, Reclaiming Authenticity, I state that everybody has been given what they need when they come into this world. As you heard me say this time and time again, their power, their energy, their gifts, their talents, resiliencies, their personality, and so forth. And yet, we fall prey to this notion that sometimes, through certain experiences, we are led to believe that in order to survive or thrive, we have to first deny. We have to first deny who we are. And we are often misled to believe that, just give away your power and settle for living by another's inauthentic definition and rules. Quite frankly, when we end up doing this, we end up searching for our true selves in all the wrong places instead of looking within our own soul. But when people fully embrace the fact that they are a soul and indeed precious in the eyes of God, the compassionate, nurturing side of humanity emerges in a very, very powerful way. These issues of prejudice and sexism and egocentrism and racism and every other kind of ism out there all go out the window. They simply cannot dwell in the higher consciousness of the soul. And this is where the great strength of humanity comes from, that we can see each other as soul and we treat each other accordingly. but helping generations heal from some horrific, traumatic issues in which, let's say, generations have learned to mistrust or they internalize skewed perceptions which affected their emotional attachments or cognitive development or social interactions. It has this multidimensional and this multi-generational effect. Yet, and I've seen this firsthand, that when generations of a family are able to come together and really address these issues, they quickly realize that healing such wounds is not a matter of placing blame, but instead understanding the impact of what's been handed down through the generations. And as I shared often with kids and teenagers, that they're the first ones to say, well, why do I have to be the one to deal with this? And, why couldn't my grandmother, my great-grandmother, grandfather do this so I didn't have to deal with it? And probably heard me say this before, but I look at the kid or I look at the teenager and I said, did you ever consider the possibility that you are the one, you are the strongest one in the family to be able to heal not just yourself, but heal your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and all the way back, from things that they just weren't strong enough to be able to heal themselves. And it creates just a wonderful shift in the person hearing this because, again, it's not a blame issue, but it's more solution-oriented. This is something that's real, definite for sure, but it's also, can be healed. And the perceptions, the destructive behaviors and so forth can be stopped within the present generation and no longer kept going forward. And there is a level of accountability and restorative justice here that also needs to be addressed. But more importantly, for families to acknowledge that perhaps the woundedness has been passed down from generations before. And, again, this could be something that the families were just reacting to. They just had no choice. Or let's say perhaps a person is struggling with an addiction. And, chances are that there's, within the family itself, that within the family system, there are certain dynamics that are going on that just reinforce that kind of woundedness. And going back through the generations then, family members just might be able to, become aware of that there may have been others who had addiction issues. And suicide is also another family dynamic that comes down through the generations. I have to confess that I have been watching the Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why, phenomenal. I highly recommend it if you have been out of high school for many, many, many years, decades or whatever. You definitely need to watch it because it is quite eye-opening and interesting what the teenagers are facing today in terms of the fact that, again, nobody wakes up and says, gee, I think I will attempt suicide today. But how these things just kind of have many, many layers to them. And in this series, 13 Reasons Why, the whole premise is the girl who had committed suicide, she had 13 very specific reasons why she was led down this road of despair in her own life. And so you can see that it has not only this layered effect, but it also involves many people. So another issue that families often deal with is this sense of powerlessness. Again, especially with suicide, even if the suicide attempts or suicides that have been completed have not occurred in the present generation. Let's say they go back, a couple generations. This feeling of hopelessness and despair may have infiltrated the family's perception of powerlessness. And I have to see if that's, if the next season of 13 Reasons Why is going to tackle this issue of is there anybody else back in the family who had committed suicide or had this kind of shame proneness to them that they really struggled with? Okay, so I'll have to keep you posted how that unfolds. But again, if you have never seen 13 Reasons Why, I certainly recommend it to you. Let's see. There's some things that we can definitely save for next week, and there's some things that we can really, keep on talking about. But let's do this. Let's stay with this one issue just a little bit longer, for the time remaining that we have. But because it is certainly important, for you out there listening, that I've just come to really appreciate working with people who struggle with intergenerational trauma. And even from like an individual standpoint, or let's say a little more like a societal standpoint or a communal family standpoint. Another nuance or characteristic of intergenerational trauma could be this communal encapsulation. Is what I would call it. It's something. It's a phenomenon that occurs that when the traumatic energy is reinforced through, like say, rigid social systems in which we'd live, and we're talking like the larger institutions of like educational, governmental, religious, healthcare, community norms and expectations, environmental or judicial, correctional, whatever the system is, those characteristics could be, just reinforcing this negative traumatic energy that entire communities, entire generations just feel locked into. Okay. So, again, unresolved trauma is not the only phenomenon that's been handed down through the generations. Certainly learned behaviors that encourage negative assumptions or prejudices or feelings of contempt and corruption toward a group of people have certainly galvanized these systems for centuries. But healing from intergenerational trauma awakens, and it reinforces a stronger, greater connection. Okay. And therefore, as I tell my clients, a tremendous courage is needed when looking at intergenerational trauma, because it does take courage for one to acknowledge and embrace the truth, and then two, to trust this transformational process, so you may be transformed into this, just great awareness that you are indeed a beautiful soul, first and foremost. And whether or not you know much about your ancestral line, or whether or not you see yourself coming from, let's say, a long history of slaves, or a long history of slave owners, or oppressors, or murderers, or healers, or victims, or blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, and so forth. Perhaps, back in the family, there's, this victimhood of addictions or suicide. These all have a physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual component to discovering the truth. And yes, indeed, the truth does set us free, but it's the freedom that comes with a tremendous amount of responsibility to continue the soul healing process in the lives of those who have come before us, and especially for those who have yet to be born. One of the things that I want to share with you in the last minutes remaining is just to encourage you to have a talk with your family this week, perhaps over Labor Day weekend, as you get out the pictures and you just you start to get reminiscent of just the lessons learned and so forth, and really asking each other, are we good? Are we healed? Is everything fine? Are you sure I have apologized for this? And if I haven't, then I need to apologize for that, or something that's still hanging around in the family that goes back, generations after generations. So, it is certainly a conversation worth having, whether or not other people in the family want to go further down that road. But just realizing that, again, it's not to blame anybody, but it's to uplift everybody and to heal everybody for the sake of, having healthier relationships in the family, as well as with everybody that you meet. Well, I want to leave you today with one of the powerful quotes that I go back to time and time again. It's from Marianne Williamson, And I first came across this quote years ago, and I really, really enjoy it because, again, this just speaks to just the positive aspects of why this is important, why is healing important, and how easy it is to become stuck in such negativity and the negative perceptions of who we think we are without realizing the truth of who we really are. Okay, and maybe you've heard of this quote before. It goes like this. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It's our light and not our darkness that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, well, who am I to be brilliant or gorgeous or talented or fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. And as we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And until next week at this day and time, please be safe. Please stay out of trouble. And as always, listen, listen, listen to the cry of your soul. Take care. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.